use Milo's hologram to destroy the company, but it would die a slow death. It could take months for the Enterprise to finally go under. In the meantime, the children could die, along with Marlow, Gorog, and James Agubu. James Agubu. As the name passes through my mind, it gives me a jolt of hope. Agubu's avatar is still here in Otherworld. If he can tell us where his real body is, we can free him. He was one of the company's top engineers. Maybe he'll know what we should do. We need to get to the ice fields, I tell Kat. Agubu's our only hope now. She nods. She must have figured it out, too. How long do we have left before Busara and Elvis pull us out? She asks. We've been here for a while now. I don't know, I admit. I think time is moving faster in here than it used to. We might be able to make it. If not, we can come back. Fawn steps up to us. Something has piqued his curiosity.
What do you hope to find in the ice fields? He asks.
A man who might be able to help us, I say. One who can rid this world of guests for good, Kat adds. I hadn't thought of it like that, but it's certainly possible. Milo stole James Agubu's software to make Otherworld. Who knows what Agubu will be able to do?
Then we'll go to the ice fields, Fawns announces. You,
he points at Elephant Boy,
and you two.
He chooses two of the children who were brought up from below deck. Small and wiry, with silvery skin that shimmers in the sunlight, they're clearly related, perhaps even twins.
The four of us will escort these guests.
I can see why Fawns would choose the big dude for an expedition. The other two children look like underfed seventh graders. They'll only be liabilities. Thanks for the offer, I tell Fawns. Kat and I can make it to the ice fields on our own. We've been there before. We know the way.
Our company is not optional, says Fawns. I would like to meet this man for myself.
The Mastermind. Fawns isn't much of a talker. He leads us back through the swamp, around the city of Imra, and down the side of the mountain, all without saying more than half a dozen words. I get the sense that the three other children in our expedition would be far more personable if he weren't around. But anyone who speaks out of turn gets knocked to the ground by the guy's giant tentacle. Fawns either hates guests, or mistrusts us, or both. I don't blame him. I just love to know why he thinks this Alexei guy is different from the rest of us. We stop for a break in the wastelands between Imra and the ice fields. Kat and I collapse beside a rocky outcropping, surrounded on all sides by sand and scrub. Fawns pokes me with the tip of his tentacle.
How are your energy levels?
He inquires. Low, I admit. The truth is, they're almost depleted. I can't even remember the last time my avatar ate. Kat seems just as exhausted. With her forehead resting on her knees, she's all but invisible in her camouflage suit. All you can see is the bow strapped across her back. I reach out to her, and Fonz's eyes widen for a fraction of a second before he quickly looks away. He's probably not used to witnessing affection between guests.
You'll need food before we begin our trek across the ice, he says.
And just so I don't think he's developing a soft spot for us, he makes sure to add,
None of us wants to carry you.
I hold out my arms as if to embrace the emptiness all around us. Thanks for the nutritional advice. Could you point us in the direction of the nearest 7-Eleven? I could really use a hot dog and a Slurpee right about now. Make mine a blue raspberry, Kat adds, her voice seeming to come out of nowhere. I swear the girl never lets me down. Fawns doesn't dignify the quip with a response.
Stay here and make a fire, he orders Elephant Boy. You.
He signals to one of the twins, who both seem as fresh and energetic as they were when we left, which makes me think I may have underestimated their usefulness.
Come with me.
The twin who's been left behind immediately gets to work gathering scrub for the fire, while Elephant Boy arranges it in a meticulous pile in the center of a circle of rocks. I wait until Fawns has disappeared over the horizon before I lean forward and speak. My name is Simon, I tell him. That's Kat. Hey, says Kat, Her face becomes visible for a moment as she lifts her head from her knees.
Probo,
he grunts back, without taking his eyes off his work. Where did Fonz go? Is there really food around here? I ask.
If there is food, Fonz will find it, Probo says. He's traveled everywhere in Otherworld. He's seen things the rest of us have not.
So you know him? Cat asks.
Everyone knows Fonz, Probo responds.
The lithe little child who's been gathering scrub scampers back in our direction with more fuel for the fire.
You're not allowed to talk to them,
she hisses at Probo when she arrives.
Screw off,
Probo replies. The small creature drops what she's gathered into his lap and darts away again.
You speak like one of us, Cat notes with amusement.
I know your kind well,
Probo replies bluntly. I'm pretty sure that's not a good thing, but his answer doesn't seem to faze Cat.
What were you doing on the boat in Nemi? She asks.
Waiting to be taken back to Karamojo, he says.
Back? I ask. I wasn't aware that children ever made it out. You escaped?
While I was at Karamojo, I heard a rumor that there were colonies of children living free in the wastelands. The day I was chosen for the hunt, I made a run for it. A few of the other prisoners begged to come with me, and I led the party into the swamp. We were free for a few hours. It was my fault we were captured. I'm too big to hide. Two bounty hunters spotted us and rounded us up. They took us to Nemi, where we were being held until Moloch's soldiers could transport us back to Karamojo.
The small creature is back with another load of scrub.
I'll tell Fonz you've been speaking to the guests, she hisses.
Do as you will, Probo says.
I can't tell if he's given up hope or just doesn't care. I suspect it's a bit of both.
Why is she so scared of Fonz? Cat whispers when the other creature is gone once more.
He rescued you both, didn't he?
The children know that if you are rescued by Fonz, you are expected to live by his rules. You trade your life for your freedom.
What kind of rules? I ask.
The first rule is no talking to guests. Ever.
What's going to happen if that little snake over there rats you out? I want to know. Probo shrugs.
We'll find out soon.
He finishes shaping the scrub into a mound and sets it on fire. I like this guy. Fonz can go to hell as far as I'm concerned. I've got Probo's back. I catch Cat's eye, and I can tell she feels the same way. I never doubted she would. We've both always had a healthy disrespect for authority. Why does Fonz think he gets to call all the shots? Cat asks.
He's the favorite companion of the guest who saves children, says Probo. The Creator is gone and Ursus is dead. Some say the man is a tyrant, but he is all we have.
I have a million more questions for Probo, but there won't be time to ask them. A scream draws my attention to the left. A tiny figure is racing toward us with a giant pink monster hot on its heels.
No!
Probo's single word is filled with more horror and disbelief than any I've ever heard. He can't believe what he's seeing. I still have no idea what it is. Cat jumps to her feet, her bow in her hands. Three arrows pierce the air. Two fall short of the mark, while one hits the larger creature in the flank. The wound does nothing to slow it down. With my dagger clenched in my fist, I break into a sprint. I can't risk throwing as I run. If I don't land a hit, I'll lose my one and only chance. The child and I will both be dead. The beast gets clearer as I get closer. I can see it's a mutant bear from the ice fields, its snowy white fur dyed pink by blood. Whose blood is anyone's guess? Most guests still avoid the ice fields, for good reason. Three more arrows fly past me and embed themselves in the beast. One of them is lodged 6 inches deep in the creature's ribcage.
The wound should have been fatal, but the beast doesn't stumble.
This isn't right. An ice bear shouldn't be here in the wastelands. An ordinary beast, even an otherworld monster, should have died by now.
The small child whizzes past me, and an instant later, I make contact with the bear. It knocks me backward as my dagger sinks into its skull. The beast roars in pain, but it doesn't fall. My knife is still sticking out of its temple. 11 inches of steel have entered the beast's brain, and yet it continues to go for the kill. I hear a gunshot, and part of the beast's head explodes in a shower of blood and tissue. A second shot follows shortly afterward, and what was left of the bear's head is blown away. The decapitated corpse falls on top of me. I'm crushed beneath it, unable to breathe.
Simon!
I hear Kat's voice and the sound of her feet as she runs my way. Soon, the bear's carcass rolls off me, and I marvel at Kat's strength. She's like one of those parents you hear about who lift cars off their kids. Then, I see Proba beside her. Kat drops to her knees and brushes the hair off my face.
Is he alive?
It's Fonz's voice, as emotionless as ever.
Yeah, I'm alive, I groan. I appreciate the concern.
Now he's looking down at me as if he sees something that interests him.
Go get dinner started, he orders Probo, and the elephant child disappears from view. You are really hurt, he notes, keeping his voice low. How is that possible?
We told you, we're not like the other guests, Kat says. When we get injured, we feel it, and when we die, we're gone for good. With Kat's assistance, I manage to sit up. Fonz kneels down, so the three of us are face to face. He's staring at us as if he's discovered a whole new species. I suppose, in some ways, he has.
Why did the bear attack you?
He asks.
What did you do?
Nothing! Kat's justifiably annoyed by the question. The thing came out of nowhere. It was chasing the twin who'd been gathering firewood. Simon and I tried to stop it.
Something was wrong with it, I add.
I glance over at the beast. Without its head, it's impossible to offer a diagnosis.
You're telling me you risked your lives to defend one of our kind?
Fonz asks. I have no idea if he's happy about it or not.
Why would you do that?
What else were we supposed to do? I ask. We couldn't stand there and watch someone get eaten.
Someone. Fonz repeats skeptically.
Oh, give me a break. Your friend saves children, I say. Why is it so hard to believe that we would too?
It's hard to know what to believe anymore, Fonz tells us.
He looks up at the sky and then around at the wasteland.
Everything is changing. Nothing is how it was meant to be. Beasts never attack otherworld children. This is the first time I've had to kill one.
I know how he feels about everything changing, but this time, I don't say a word. Maybe someday we'll swap stories over beers, but Fonz doesn't seem like the sort of guy who's interested in having a shoulder to cry on.
Are you able to stand?
He asks me.
I think so, I tell him.
Kat hops up first and offers a hand. I'm a bit wobbly, but I'm on my feet.
Good,
Fonz says. This time, he actually sounds like he means it.
Come to the fire. I found food.
The three other children are already seated in a circle around the fire, using sticks to make kebabs out of something that still appears to be wriggling.
I am Ita,
says the child Kat and I saved. She points to the identical child sitting beside her.
That is my sister, Ino.
All rules still apply,
Fonz grumbles, and both mouths instantly seal. But no one got whacked by his tentacle, and our little companion has managed to make one thing perfectly clear. She won't be ratting out Probo for speaking to the guests. My eyes dart in his direction, and for the first time I get a good look at the meal he's making. 12 large scorpions impaled on sticks are waiting to be roasted. My knees buckle at the sight of their iridescent green exoskeletons glinting in the firelight. The scorpion back in Texas looked just like them. Cat manages to catch me before I fall all the way to the ground.
Simon, what's wrong? She asks, her voice a worried whisper. Are you okay?
No, I tell her honestly. I'm not okay at all. I wish I could say more, but this is neither the time nor the place.
Sit him down, Fonz orders. He needs food.
The two smaller children hop up and help Cat guide me to a seat. A leather bag gets moved to make a place for me at the fire. A giant green scorpion scuttles out from inside it and scampers over my shoe before it vanishes into the scrub. I think I need a lot more than food. Nothing is how it was meant to be. The whole way to the ice fields, that thought has been bouncing around in my head. Milo Jokin's world is falling apart, and it's taking mine down with it. Things that belong only in this world have been showing up in the real world. Characters who belong in neither place have been making cameos, too. Today, we passed through a snowstorm on the way to the glacier. Though it could have been my imagination, I thought I saw a figure standing in the distance. It was nothing but a gray blur in the middle of all that white. But for a moment, I could have sworn it was the Kishka. Cat must have seen me staring into the snow. She's been quite attentive for the past few hours, which tells me she must be concerned. I wish I could say I'll be all right, but I'm no longer sure I will be. We've arrived at Magna's ice cave and found it crumbling. It's a good thing we decided to come when we did, because I'm not sure how much longer this place will last. Fonz orders Probo and Ida to stand guard outside as the rest of us enter. Inside the tunnel, there are cracks in the ceiling that are wide enough to shove my whole arm into. As we walk down the path, we can hear the ice creaking and groaning above us. At the end of the path lies the empty throne room. I remember Magna, Milo's avatar, sitting in the center, the heat from his burning red body carving this chamber out of the glacier. Most traces of Magna are gone now. Even the door that once served as Milo Jokin's personal exit from Otherworld. The company must have removed it. But thankfully, they've left what we've come to find. They must not have realized it's here, buried deep inside the cave's wall. You'd have to look closely to see that the hazy silhouette belongs to a man trapped in the ice. We're here to take him out. Fonz lights a torch and holds the flame to the wall. I can feel the heat of the blaze on my cheeks. Slowly, the ice begins to recede, and the figure becomes darker and more distinct. Then, Fonz pulls the torch away from the ice and gestures for Eno to come closer.
"Who's in there?"
she asks Fonz. She doesn't dare direct the question to us. I answer anyway. "An avatar. It belongs to the man who's responsible for your world."
"The Creator?"
she asks. "No," I tell her. "Before the Creator."
"How could there be someone before the Creator?"
she asks.
"That's enough," Fonz snaps. "No more talking."
I shoot him a look. I'm not one of his kind. I don't have to take orders from jerks with tentacles for tails. Eno places her hands on the dripping wall. Her silver skin turns pink, and then a blazing red, and what's left of the ice melts away, and the face of a handsome man begins to emerge. There's no doubt the guy is Busara's father. They share the same prominent cheekbones and regal nose. Next, Eno melts the ice around his chest and arms. As soon as his first hand is freed, it rises to his face, where his fingers wipe the moisture away from his eyes. When they open, they land right on me.
"A druid," he says,
and I swear I almost give the dude a hug. Apparently, he's the only person in Otherworld who knows a kick-ass avatar when he sees one. He glances down at the amulet around my neck.
"A druid who's wearing a disc. To what do I owe the pleasure?"
God, where do I start? I guess I didn't think through the introductions. Cat notices me struggling to put a sentence together and steps in just as things are about to get awkward.
"We've come to set you free," she tells him.
"Ah," says James Agubu.
There's a smile on his face, but he's hardly jumping for joy. His eyes pass over Cat and move on to our companions.
"Such creative avatars." We are not guests in Otherworld, Fonz informs him. We are children.
Eno's finished defrosting the Avatar, and James Agubu steps out of the ice. Tall and slim, he's wearing dad jeans and a pale blue button-down. His shoes look like he bought them from a medical supply shop. I'd love to know what the children make of his outfit. Even on Earth, it would be a little unusual. Agubu holds out a hand to Fonz, who seems confused. I guess no one's ever attempted to shake his hand before.
I've heard about your kind, but I was never lucky enough to meet any of you, Agubu says. May I ask who your parents are? My father is the elemental of Nemi, Fonz responds warily. My mother is the beast from below. She lives at the bottom of the Nemi Sea.
You're an aristocrat, Agubu notes, without sounding the slightest bit smarmy. His daughter may have inherited his looks, but Busara got none of his charm. He glances over at Eno and smiles warmly. And your father must be the one your kind call the Creator. How could I have missed it? Of course he was. The burning red hands that she used to melt the ice away from James Agubu make perfect sense now. That's why Eno and her sister were invited along.
Where is he? Agubu asks, looking around. This is still Magna's cave, is it not? The Creator has left Otherworld, Fonz announces. He abandoned us all.
Milo is dead, I explain. The game killed him. The company allowed it to happen.
Milo?
Fonz asks. He's never heard the name. I'll explain later, I tell him. But James Agubu doesn't hesitate.
Milo was the man who used my inventions to build your world, he tells Fonz. His avatar was Magna, otherwise known as the Creator. The Creator was a guest? Fonz asks.
Yes, Agubu tells him. While Fonz struggles to absorb the information, Agubu turns to me.
You're certain Milo is dead.
The news doesn't appear to have brought him pleasure. I grimace at the memory of Milo's withered corpse. I saw the body with my own eyes. Agubu nods sadly.
I knew it would happen eventually. Otherworld had already destroyed Milo's mind. There was little doubt that his body was next. The last time I saw him, he was skin and bones. But if Milo is dead now, who sent you to free me?
Your daughter, Kat tells him. She's been looking for you.
Busara!
Agubu's eyes brighten and fill with tears. It's touching to witness, but I can't help but be struck by the irony of it all. This is the man who invented the disc. The same technology that's killed so many people started with Agubu's desire to help a daughter with heart problems. It's hard to believe that something as pure and wonderful as his love for his child could have led to a world that's so rotten and wrong. But that's the big lesson I've learned here in Otherworld. You can't predict how things will eventually turn to shit. You can only accept that they will.
How is her heart? Is she well?
Busara's fine, Kat assures him. She's anxious to see you. And she'll probably be much easier to live with as soon as we locate you, I imagine. It may be my imagination, but James Agubu's image seems to flicker for a moment.
I don't understand. You have located me, he says.
There's something off about this guy, though I'm having trouble putting a finger on what it could be. I suppose he seems far too composed for the situation, like his real-world body has been hooked up to a strong sedative drip. Then again, who knows what's flowing through Agubu's veins right now?
We found you here. Now we need to find you in the real world, I explain. Do you have any idea where your body might be?
Yes, says Agubu with a cryptic smile. It's in a long, narrow container just large enough to hold it. He's describing a capsule. That's as specific as I can be at the moment. After all, we've only just met.
No rush, Kat assures him. When you're ready to tell us, we'll be happy to listen.
I look over at her with a raised eyebrow.
I'm glad she's feeling confident. If he doesn't spill the beans, we could end up back at square one.
You're certain that finding my body's the best use of your time? Agubu asks her.
This guy is way too cool. It's not really up for debate, I say. Your daughter's going to drive me completely insane if we don't get you home soon. And we need your help. As you probably predicted, Otherworld's gotten a wee bit out of control.
Otherworld was never under control, Agubu replies. This world should not have been built.
This is our home, Fonz jumps in, sounding pissed. Without Otherworld, the children would not exist.
Of course. Agubu places a hand on the child's shoulder. I apologize. I didn't mean to be callous. This subject has grown far more complicated since I last discussed it. There are no easy answers today. Perhaps there never were.
Otherworld isn't the problem, Fonz responds. Guests like you are the problem.
I see Cat grimace, but Agubu doesn't react to the insult.
He's like us, I inform Fonz. He's not wearing a headset. He's not here to kill.
Headset players are the biggest issue at the moment, Cat tells Agubu. There are 2,000 in Otherworld, and they've been slaughtering children for sport. There's an entire realm devoted to the hunt.
Agubu's head bows forward, and his hands rise to his face. A few seconds pass before he speaks. When he does, his voice is filled with grief.
I'm so sorry, he tells Fonz. I warned Milo that such atrocities were likely, but he refused to listen. He thought he was powerful enough to control the world he created, and he assumed he was brilliant enough to govern his guests. I suppose in the end, he was neither.
When the children first appeared, Milo set out to exterminate them. Later, he realized what terrible acts he'd committed, and he brought me here, hoping I'd help find another solution. He told me he'd scrapped the disc. Going forward, only headset players would be allowed into Otherworld. He thought I'd be pleased, but I knew what that would mean for Otherworld's inhabitants. Total annihilation. So I came back here on my own, and I brought something with me that would put an end to all of it. But Milo found out, just as I prepared to unleash it. That's why he imprisoned my mind in this cave, and that's why I've been here ever since.
What were you planning to unleash? Cat asks.
A virus, Agubu says. One specially designed to destroy the headsets Milo created and spare Otherworld's inhabitants.
My heart skips a beat, but it's too good to be true. The virus is exactly what we need, and it's within our reach. It's like coming across the Holy Grail mixed in with the mugs in your kitchen cabinet.
Will it destroy the discs? Cat asks.
No, Agubu tells her. I didn't think destroying them would be necessary. Never in my wildest dreams did I imagine that anyone other than Milo or myself would ever enter this game with a disc.
What is a virus? Fonz demands.
His tone of voice could use an adjustment, but it must be frustrating to keep up a conversation with beings from another world.
A virus is a piece of code that can replicate itself and destroy software, Cat says.
The explanation seems to do nothing for Fonz.
It will kill all the new guests, I say. Then I meet Agubu's eyes. And we need it.
Then bring my daughter to me, James Agubu says. I will tell her where to find the virus, and where she can locate my body.
I'm confused. Shouldn't Agubu, of all people, know why that's not going to happen? His daughter isn't well enough to fight headset players. This game is too dangerous for Busara now. Even the liminal spaces are filled with psychos and beasts. We have no access to headsets, only discs. If we brought Busara here, there's a good chance that she'd be butchered or eaten if her heart didn't give out first.
I pause for a moment when I hear Cat sigh. My words may have been harsh, but that doesn't mean they weren't true.
You have no choice but to trust us.
Placing my trust in the wrong people is why I'm here today, Agubu reminds me. The virus may be the only chance the children have.
I assume you know how the company operates. Do you think it would be wise for me to entrust the virus to strangers? He has an excellent point. We could be company engineers, as far as he knows.
Find a headset, he tells us. Bring Busara to me, and I will tell her how to release the virus. That could take a while, I sigh.
No,
I hear Fawn say. I turn my attention to him, and he's pulled out his weapon.
We cannot wait. If this virus of yours can free my kind, you must release it now.
A gun? Agubu notes solemnly, his eyes on Fonz's weapon. You're right. Otherworld has changed. Such weapons were forbidden the last time I was free.
Put that thing away, Kat demands, but Fonz ignores her. These two claim they can die in Otherworld like the children,
Fonz tells Agubu, gesturing to Kat and me.
If you're like them, that means you can die too. Tell me where to find the virus, or I'll shoot you.
If I die, you'll never find the answer you seek, the older man points out. You can either be patient and let me hand over the virus to someone I trust, or you can lose your best hope of saving your kind. It is your choice. Which will it be? A loud crack echoes through the chamber. Another wide fissure has opened up in the ice above our heads. Fawns draws in a deep breath and reluctantly puts his gun away. I hear Kat exhale.
Well, aren't we all glad that's over, she says. Now let's get Mr. Agubu out of this cave. It's not going to last much longer.
Agubu studies the ceiling. You're probably right, but I'm afraid I can't leave.
What?
Another obstacle has been thrown in our way, and Kat groans.
Why the hell not?
I'm safer in here than I would be out there. I can't afford to take any risks. As you know all too well, if I die, I'll be gone for good. For some reason, an image of Gorog flashes through my mind. I watch the ogre get speared through the chest, and yet the boy who controlled the avatar is still, somehow, alive. I know that's how it usually works, I say. I've seen it happen, but there's a 13-year-old kid from Elizabeth, New Jersey, who was murdered in Otherworld, but survived in real life. The company thinks he's proof that the discs can be fixed. They may be right, Agubu responds, but they'll never figure out how to do it. Do you think you could? I ask. Agubu shakes his head. If I were able to study the survivor, perhaps, but that's not going to happen now, is it? If you tell Busara where your real body's located, we can... Agubu stops me. When you bring me my daughter, don't take any chances. If you want me to speak with her, she must be wearing a headset, not a disc.
Fine, Kat tells him. We got it.
The ice all around us is cracking like a bowl of Rice Krispies.
Let's go, she tells me. We've got to figure out how to get our hands on a headset. Know anyone who could loan us $500,000 or so?
I follow her out, feeling far more hopeless than I did going in. I understand Agubu's reasons for refusing to help us, but I'm not really up for another hurdle right now.
I can help, Fawn says behind us.
I'd forgotten he was there, and that I'm still royally pissed that he pulled a gun in the ice cave.
Oh, really?
I snap. Let me guess, you've been saving up for a rainy day? Fawn's brow furrows. He clearly has no idea what I'm talking about.
My friend, Alexei.
Your friend, Alexei, I laugh out loud. Why would he want a virus release? In case you haven't figured it out, he's a goddamn headset player.
Which means he has a headset you might use, Fawn says.
Kat glances over at me.
Why would your friend want to help us? He wouldn't help you,
Fawns replies.
He will help me and the rest of the children.
He says it with such reverence that I'd almost swear he was talking about Jesus or Superman or some combination of both. Maybe this Alexei dude should start his own cult. Look, I understand he's your hero and all, but do you have any idea who your buddy Alexei is in the real world?
I demand. He might not be a very nice guy.
The real world?
Fawn sneers back.
Otherworld is real enough to me. I know who Alexei is here. As far as I'm concerned, that is all that matters.
Do you really think he'll listen to you? Kat asks.
Certainly,
Fawns replies, without a trace of doubt. Apparently, he's convinced that their affection is mutual.
Then arrange a meeting for us with Alexei, she says.
In the real world, I add, just to be obnoxious.
When?
Fawns wants to know. Tomorrow, I reply, stomping off toward the exit. At noon.
Tomorrow? Kat asks. Isn't that a bit early? Don't we need some time to figure out who this guy really is or where he's at?
His name is Alexei Semenov, I call back. He lives in New York. I get to the end of the tunnel and step outside into the icy air. It takes me a moment to realize I'm the only one here. Probo and Ida are nowhere to be seen. I'm about to complain that our guards have abandoned us when Kat reaches out for my arm and drags me back inside the cave. I see she has a finger pressed to her lips. Crouched down low, Fawn shuffles past us and examines the footprints in the snow outside. When he stands up, he points at me.
Come, he says softly.
Kat and I both start to follow him.
You stay here,
Fawn orders her.
Screw you, Kat says. I go where he goes.
You think 'cause I'm female I can't take care of myself?
Of course not,
Fawn says, as though nothing she just said made any sense.
I chose him because he's the annoying one. If anything happens, I'd rather he died.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to let that happen either. Kat pulls her hood up and disappears from view. Before I lose sight of her, she looks almost amused. I bend down and take a moment to study the footprints in the snow. Probo and Ida took off to the right. They seemed to be moving fast, but if they were running away, they chose the most difficult route. The path they took is all uphill. If I had to guess, I'd say they were running towards something. Fawns takes the lead as the three of us head in the same direction as the missing children. Soon, I hear male voices in the distance.
You get a great trophy, and I get third-degree burns? How the hell is that fair? Quit bitching. I told you to turn down the sensitivity on the haptic response gloves. Those things can scald the hell out of you. Yeah, but what's the point of doing this if you can't feel the hot blood? By the way, did you see how the thing turned bright red when I grabbed it? What'd I say? The real fighters are still out in the wild. All those ones back in Karamojo are just the ones that gave up.
I can see them now. Two burly men dressed in Arctic camo. They've both got assault rifles.
Where are they getting this stuff?
Nothing like that was available when I got to choose my weapon. My vision blurs, and my brain is boiling as the rage fills me. My mind no longer functioning. I race forward across the ice, my dagger in hand. I'm on the two avatars before they even know I'm coming. I slit the first one's throat with a single slice. The avatar flashes, and I immediately slam my dagger between its ribs. He must have lost one life already, because the second time he flashes, he disappears. His friend has had just enough time to jump to his feet. He has a gun aimed at my temple when one of Kat's arrows gets him right between the eyes. There's a single flash, and he's gone. The avatars have vanished, but two bodies are left behind, one giant and one small. The scream that comes from Ino makes my blood run cold. She runs past us through the snow and throws herself over her sister's limp, broken corpse. The homebody. I open my eyes. Busara is kneeling over me, the disc I was wearing in her hand. I hear Kat sobbing on the bed beside me.
Oh my God, what's going on?
There's real fear written across Busara's face.
We saw tears pouring out from under Kat's visor, and we thought something must have happened to you.
It's not me. I'm fine, I tell Busara as I roll over to Kat.
We'll get the headset, I promise her. We'll stop the slaughter.
I don't give a damn what it takes. I've only seen Kat cry twice in the 10 years that I've known her, and both times she'd broken a bone. This time, there's no pill that can ease the pain. It's up to me to do something, and there is absolutely nothing I wouldn't do to keep Kat from suffering like this. Simon, I hear Elvis in the background. Give us a few minutes alone, I tell him. No. Kat sits up and wipes her face on her shirt. We've got to get out of here. Remember what Wayne said? He knows who Elvis and Busara are. The company's looking for all of us. Kat slides off the bed and immediately starts stuffing things into plastic bags. I'd almost forgotten about our lovely dinner with Wayne. Seems like a lifetime ago. We should have left Otherworld sooner, Kat continues. Everyone's depending on us, and we're sitting ducks if we stay in one place too long. I don't get it, Busara says. You guys were only in Otherworld for a couple of hours. We pulled you out right when we were supposed to. Kat stops. No, we were there for at least 2 Earth days, maybe longer. Elvis is shaking his head.
No, you were there for 120 minutes.
I was right. Time is speeding up in Otherworld, which means we need to move a hell of a lot faster in this one.
By the way, just out of curiosity, how did Wayne find out about me?
Elvis asks. And I shrug. It's an excellent question. So I guess he didn't agree to our terms, Busara asks. Not even close, I say. He tried to force us to reveal our real-world location. Kat and I managed to escape, and then we went to the ice cave. 2 children who came with us were killed outside the cave. That's why Kat was crying. Busara is oddly quiet. Her eyes lit up at the mention of the ice cave. I know she's dying to ask about her dad, but she doesn't want me to yell at her for being insensitive. Her silence makes me as angry as the question would have. Yes, the 2 children who died were brave and wonderful creatures. They definitely didn't deserve to be murdered by a couple of assholes who think it's sporting to shoot unarmed beings with assault rifles.
God, Elvis groans.
Busara's face is stony.
I'm really sorry, she says.
Oh, and we saw your dad, I tell her. We freed his avatar from the ice. Her eyes grow big.
And, she asks cautiously, do we know where to find his body?
Nope, I answer. The response sounds mean, even to my ears, so I soften my tone. He wouldn't tell us, but he has a virus that can destroy all the Otherworld headsets. He wouldn't give it to us, though. He wants to talk to you. Busara races for the bathroom.
I need a razor, she shouts.
The hair on the back of her head has been growing in. She'd need to shave it for a disc to adhere. Kat follows her.
You can't use a disc, she says.
Busara spins around.
What? Why not? You heard what Simon said.
Did you? I snap. I just told you we saw 2 children get slaughtered right outside the ice cave. Even the liminal spaces are no longer safe.
Your dad wants us to get you a headset. And he's right, Kat says. Otherworld is changing, fast. There are no safe places anymore. The entire world is filled with psychos and beasts. You'd end up having to fight, and we all know your heart might not be able to take it. Please, my dad needs me, Busara pleads. You're worried about my heart, but I swear it's going to crack right in half if I stay here and do nothing.
I'll go with Busara,
Elvis volunteers, looking like the handsome doomed soldier in some Hollywood movie.
She won't have to fight at all. I'll take care of anything that comes at her.
I get the sense that Elvis would happily take a bullet for Busara Ogubu, which boggles my mind. Since the day they met, the girl has been nothing but cold to him. Still, he'd sacrifice anything to impress her. But as noble as Elvis's latest offer may be, there's no way I'm going to let her take him up on it. Without Kat or me, they'd both be as good as dead.
Listen, guys, I plead. There might be a better solution.
Busara looks devastated. I had no idea she was capable of caring this much about anything.
Listen to Simon, Kat counsels her. Give him a chance.
We've arranged to meet someone who has a headset, I say. If we can convince him to let us borrow it, you'll be able to go to Otherworld safely.
Who is it? Elvis demands.
Alexei Semenov. Elvis throws his head back and aims a frustrated groan at the ceiling.
Are you kidding me? Do you know anything about that guy? 'Cause I do. Alexei Semenov is not the sort of person you want to be making deals with. They call guys like him oligarchs, but they're really just gangsters.
Elvis is acting like I'm some kind of idiot. I'm not exactly thrilled about the situation either.
Look, Semenov's in New York, I say. He has a headset. We got word to him that we'd be at his house today at noon. Do you have any better ideas? 'Cause if you do, now is definitely the time to speak up.
Elvis doesn't look pleased, but at least he keeps his mouth shut.
Who's going? Kat asks.
Elvis and me, I say.
What?
Elvis yelps.
When did I sign up for a suicide mission? You speak Russian, I shouted him. And unless I was hallucinating a few seconds ago, you offered to be Busara's personal otherworld bodyguard. Going to see Semenov is a hell of a lot safer than that.
Fine, Elvis snips.
But the things I offered to do for Busara's body do not apply to yours. We go to Semenov's. You guard your own ass.
Who said Simon was going? Kat asks. What if I want to meet this guy?
Good God. Why the hell does everything have to be so hard?
One look at her, and I know she's not going to let this go.
Grab a quarter, I tell her.
I won the toss. Or lost, depending on how you look at it. Alexei lives in a Beaux Arts limestone mansion on the Upper East Side. The place has so many embellishments that it looks like a 5-tier wedding cake. Until recently, the place was the Embassy of Luxembourg. You can still see the dark square on the wall where the bronze plaque was removed.
We could die in there, Elvis says, pensively.
Of course we could. But it's fucking rude of him to point that out, if you ask me. Let me get this straight. You're totally fine going back and forth to Otherworld where everything wants to kill you or eat you, but you're terrified of asking some Russian dude if you can borrow his headset?
Beasts and guests are one thing, says Elvis. Russians are another. Do you remember when that meteor hit Russia a few years ago? Remember all the dashboard videos that showed a giant ball of fire flying right over people's cars? Did you happen to notice that nobody stopped? They all kept driving toward the spot where the meteor was about to hit. You don't screw with Russians, man. They are hardcore.
I sigh with annoyance.
Do you have a point? If so, could you get to it? 'Cause it's almost noon, and I bet our hardcore Russian friend won't be too happy if we show up late.
I'm just thinking that if we're about to die, there's a question I'd like you to answer first.
Fine, I huff. Ask.
So, what do you think I'm doing wrong?
Elvis suddenly sounds like a man in agony.
I've spent God knows how many hours alone with Busara, and she barely even looks at me. Sometimes when I ask her things, all she'll do is grunt. I mean, it's kind of sexy, but it's hard to hold a conversation that way.
I lock eyes with him. There's no doubt he's completely sincere. This is not what I needed at this particular moment. You really want my advice? Right here? Right now? I ask, and Elvis nods, hopefully.
Give up on Busara. There's something off about her. I told you back in New Mexico. I'm not 100% sure she's human.
She said my name in her sleep, Elvis tells me, his voice dialed down as if someone could be listening.
I hope I'm doing a reasonable job of concealing my disgust.
I thought you just said you haven't gotten anywhere with her.
We weren't sleeping together, he explains. She passed out from exhaustion one night when we were working on the projector. I heard her whisper,
Elvis.
She said it sweetly, too. I swear, it was the greatest moment of my life.
You really like this girl, don't you? I ask, though I can't quite believe it.
Elvis nods silently. Why in the hell would someone like Elvis fall for a girl with less personality than an NPC?
She's a genius, he says, answering my unspoken question. I've never met anyone who can do what she does.
Then I don't know what to tell you, I say with a sigh. Maybe dial the dirty jokes down a notch.
Okay,
he says, obviously glad to have a plan.
I can do that.
And get your hands on a headset that will help her visit her dad. That's the way to really win her over.
I can do that too, Elvis exclaims. Awesome,
I respond with fake enthusiasm. Then let's do it. I know you're screwing with me right now, but I'm really glad we had this talk, Elvis says as we cross the street. Me too, I tell him. And though I said it to placate him, it's not really a lie. I wish like hell he'd set his sights on someone else, but I do like seeing him happy. I step up to the carved wooden doors on the front of Semenov's mansion and press a small white buzzer that I assume is the doorbell. A man in a perfectly cut three-piece suit answers. He's got to be 7 feet tall, and there isn't a single hair on his head. He glares down at the two of us without saying a word. Elvis speaks to him in Russian. The man growls something brusque in response and then slams the door in our faces.
That's it? I ask.
He's not going to let us in? I knew this house call wasn't going to be a walk in the park, but I didn't expect it to be over quite so quickly.
He says we have to use the servants' entrance, Elvis snarls, kicking a concrete planter which doesn't budge.
What? I'm momentarily offended. It lasts all of 10 seconds. Elvis appears to be taking the insult far more personally. I'm also worried he may have broken a toe.
This is some serious bullshit,
I hear him muttering to himself as he limps away from the door.
I'm an American.
To the left of the main entrance, wedged between Alexei's mansion and his neighbor's, is a narrow metal gate. I hear a buzzer sound as we approach, and I rush over just in time to push the gate open. Then Elvis and I squeeze between the garbage bags that are waiting to be collected in the narrow alley that leads to the service entrance. The door swings out into the alley, and a smaller man, in an identical suit, ushers us inside.
Hello, the small man says in heavily accented English. My apologies. We are not set up for guests. We've had to make special arrangements for you. Please.
He ushers us into an enormous kitchen. Sitting at a long wooden table are six more men in identical suits drinking coffee. Alexei has his own private army. The only thing that surprises me is how dapper they are. Alexei must spend a fortune on bespoke suits every year. We follow the small man out of the kitchen and into a nearby room lined with metal lockers. At the far end is a stainless steel door.
Please.
The man opens two of the lockers. Inside are pale blue jumpsuits and matching booties.
Change here. When you are done, the door will open for you.
Is this necessary? I ask. I swear to God, I've had all my shots, and we aren't planning to stay very long.
Yes, the man says bluntly. It is necessary.
Then he turns back toward the kitchen, leaving us on our own. What do you want to bet this is some Howard Hughes shit? I say as I yank off my sneakers. Our new buddy is probably terrified of germs. Maybe he collects all his fingernail clippings and keeps his piss in mason jars like Hughes did.
Yeah, I don't know.
Elvis sounds unusually somber.
I bet it's going to get a lot weirder than that.
When Elvis and I are dressed in our snazzy blue outfits, the door slides open. Beyond it is a small stainless steel room. Each of the four walls features a grid of tiny round holes. We step inside and the door slides shut and seals behind us. There's a whoosh, and fog sprays from the holes. It's some kind of decontamination shower. Whatever they're spraying us with smells like an industrial pesticide. I hold my breath and hope it ends before I pass out. 30 seconds later, the jet shut off, another door opens, and we step out germ-free. A man wearing a pale blue jumpsuit just like ours greets us on the other side. He hands us each a hairnet, face mask, and gloves.
"What'd I tell you?"
Elvis says. The next stop is the Twilight Zone.
I think he may be right. Everything around us is a spotless white. The walls, floors, and furniture all blend together. There are no windows, but the space is lit by a warm golden light that feels like the sun. Elvis and I are led from room to room until we hear the bubbling of water. The man who's been leading us stops at a doorway and steps aside to let us pass through it. I guess he hasn't been asked to join the party. I'm the first to enter. The air inside is warm and humid, and the room is empty aside from two chairs that have been positioned near the edge of a bubbling pool, which I now suspect is some sort of physical therapy tub. I see the top half of a naked man sticking out of the water. At least, I think it's a man. Given the condition of the person's skin, it's kind of hard to tell. Large patches on his chest, arms, and face appear to have melted away. I'm thankful the rolling water hides the rest of him. The bits I can see are difficult to look at.
"I am Alexei Semenov," he says bluntly. "You are Simon Eaton and Elvis Karashevich."
It's the sort of welcome you'd expect from a Bond villain. Alexei does not disappoint.
"May I ask how you know?" I say.
Alexei gestures towards the ceiling with his chin.
"There are security cameras everywhere,"
he says in an American accent that's practically flawless.
"Our facial recognition software provided online matches. I must be careful, you know. The people who did this to me are quite eager to finish the job."
I should probably keep my mind focused on the task at hand, but it's impossible not to wonder how anyone could survive whatever happened to Alexei Semenov. His nose and one ear are completely gone, as is his hair. But there is enough left of him to see that he once looked a lot like his avatar.
"Believe it or not, I used to be pretty."
He jokes as if he were just eavesdropping on my thoughts. I think he's trying to grin, and the result is hideous.
"A year ago, the ladies couldn't get enough of me."
"I bet there are still a lot of ladies out there who wouldn't give a damn what you look like," Elvis observes.
It sounds incredibly rude to my ears, but Alexei laughs. I guess they share the same sense of humor.
"This is true,"
says Alexei, his voice hoarse from laughing.
"But the doctors tell me I am prone to infection. Plus, I'm afraid my lower half looks far worse than my top. After I was poisoned, they threw acid on me and it ate away all my favorite parts."
I can only imagine what he's alluding to.
"I'm sorry," I say. I shouldn't have. Alexei Semenov doesn't want my sympathy.
"For what?"
he snaps.
"If you'd had anything to do with this, you'd be dead by now. Devising ways to punish my enemies is now a favorite pastime of mine. So what do you say, gentlemen? Let's get to the point. My friend Fonz tells me you two have a proposition for me. What is it?"
"We need an otherworld headset," Elvis tells him. "You are the only person we know who has one."
"That doesn't sound like a proposition," says Alexei. "It sounds like a favor. I don't grant favors, especially to people who look like they can do nothing for me in return."
"But we can," I say.
"Didn't Fonz tell you? If you let us borrow your gear, we will eliminate all of the other players. You can save the children and have Otherworld all to yourself."
"Even if you were capable of such a thing, why would you imagine that's what I would want?"
Alexei asks.
"I don't understand," I say, feeling a bit flummoxed.
"Fonz told us..."
Alexei wades over to the edge of the pool and motions for us to step forward, as if he wants to tell us a secret.
"I have been a very bad man,"
he says once we're closer.
"Just look at me. People would not have done this if I'd been a nice guy. So, you know what I decided to do when I got to Otherworld? I decided I would try to be good. Give it a shot. See if I like it.
And you know what? I figured the question was rhetorical, but he's